Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined by my partner in this enterprise, Elliot Cohen, the Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and a professor of strategy, retired at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, now I guess technically emeritus. Elliot, how are you today?
Well, I'm okay, but I was going through the mailbag, Eric, and of course these days you sometimes get these things by Twitter, and there's some guy named Jeff Mason 7013 on Twitter, and he said the following: "While I appreciate these contributors' erudition, I can't help being reminded of the curmudgeonly and cantankerous Muppets, Statler and Waldorf, from the balcony." Now, I just want to say, I mean, Jeff, wherever you are, we have feelings too. Actually, I'm not sure I have feelings. But do you have feelings?
But the truth is, you and I have frequently compared ourselves to Statler and Waldorf.
Yeah, that's actually true. Okay, Jeff, you're forgiven.
You know, before we get started with our guest who is returning for a second appearance on Shield of the Republic, I just want to say I did watch earlier today the event that our Bulwark colleague, our publisher, Sarah Longwell, hosted in Pennsylvania with Vice President Kamala Harris and Liz Cheney, whom we had on Shield earlier this year. And it was a remarkable, absolutely remarkable event. And very proud of Sarah and really delighted that we are on this Bulwark platform. And I think we will probably put a link to our podcast with Liz in the show notes for this show. But I want to get on with the show. We're delighted to welcome back Major General retired Mick Ryan of the Australian Army. Mick is not only a former student of both Elliot's and mine at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, but had a very distinguished career in the Australian military. He's the author of two very good books, War Transformed, which I commend to all our listeners and viewers on YouTube, and most recently, War for Ukraine, Strategy and Adaptation Under Fire, which we'll be discussing today. And he also is the prolific author of a Substack, Futura Doctrina, which I also commend to listeners. If you don't subscribe to it, please sign up and get it, because it will help you understand the war in Ukraine. Mick, welcome back to Shield of the Republic.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks, Elliot. It's great to be back with my old professors for this conversation. Actually, Elliot, we're still my professors.
Elliot, I know, has already, as he said in the green room, worked you over at a book event at CSIS. So I think I'll start and then he can gently take up his cudgel later.
I'm just going to warn you, Eric, we weren't able to break him there. I don't think we'll be able to do it here either. So
I doubt it. I mean, I learned a lot from the book, and the research behind it, I have to say, Mick, is really prodigious in terms of pulling together lots of things that I had also read, you know, some of the publications by Russi and others, but also a lot of things I hadn't read or thought about. So it's really, you know, I think of the books that focus on the war per se, as opposed to the broader, you know, political ambiance around it, like Owen Matthews' Overreach, which you also cite, and we had Owen on our show as well. This book really concentrates on the kind of warp and woof of the war itself, on the military dimension, and it's great. So the book is about strategy and adaptation in warfare under fire and the changing character of war. Talk a little bit, if you could, for our listeners and viewers about the going in strategies for both Russia and Ukraine. Point you make is very strongly is that, you know, all strategies are to some degree prisoners of the assumptions that the people behind the strategies make going in and their ability to adjust, you know, those assumptions to the reality they encounter. Talk a little bit about how that's all played out in your view.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. The Russian strategy, I think I'll focus on first. You know, it really was a short-term strategy based on three key assumptions. That firstly, that the Ukrainian military would not fight hard, that it was the Ukrainian military that they'd come up against 10 years before. Secondly, that the Ukrainian government would probably fold, possibly go into exile, but they could be replaced. And the third assumption was that NATO or the West would not put up any kind of significant obstruction to Russia's subjugation of Ukraine, very similar to what had happened in the wake of Crimea and the Donbass. As it turns out, all three of those assumptions were wrong, and they critically undermined Russia's strategy of a rapid advance on Kyiv and a takeover of the government there in the beginning of their campaign in 2022. Russia, after losing the Battle of Kyiv, really had to reset, rethink its strategy. And it took them some time. They, you know, they refocused in the east. But by September, I think they'd reset their strategy to the one we see now still, which is the long war, wait out the West, slowly strangle Ukraine. And to accompany that was their mobilization, not just to people, but industry. I think too many missed their mobilization of industry in September 2022. And I think Putin feels that he has a pretty good chance at the moment of this strategy working. I think Ukraine's initial strategy was really just survive the initial onslaught. The success in the Battle of Kyiv, I think, gave them the opportunity to partially reset and broaden their strategy to not just surviving the Battle of Kyiv and holding the Russians where they were in the east and the south, but possibly thinking about beating the Russians. And their success in Kharkiv and Kherson at the end of 2022 probably gave them at least some reason to embrace that kind of strategy. Unfortunately, they've never been their own masters. They've always been reliant on Western support, and any strategy embraced by Ukraine is really reliant on the diplomatic, financial, and military support from the West, which, to be fair, has allowed them to hold the line, but it will has not allowed them really to beat the Russians in Ukraine.
The Russians, you know, adjustment, one of the adjustments was that they didn't have enough forces, as you say, to execute the kind of far-reaching regime change strategy that they initially had. And so that led Putin to declare, as you describe in the book, a partial mobilization in the fall of 22. But it strikes me, and I'm interested in your response to this, it strikes me that the partial mobilization was also a tacit recognition of a political vulnerability of Putin's, which is that the partial mobilization essentially allowed them to dragoon folks from Siberia, ethnic minorities, Tuvins, Buryats, others, into the Russian military, while not declaring a full mobilization, which would have entailed mobilizing people from St. Petersburg and Moscow and Nizhny Novgorod and other places in European Russia. And you also saw a exodus of about a million young men who were worried that they were going to get caught up in the mobilization. So my reading of this, tell me if I'm wrong, is that that has enabled the Russians to bring in, you know, 300,000 plus people into service, but they are not terribly well trained. They're not highly motivated. And as you document, they're being thrown into battle, frequently ill-equipped, and as part of these so-called meat assaults, just literally attempt to overwhelm the Ukrainians with mass attacks of people. And even that, at that, they're having difficulty. And we now see reports that they're bringing in, you know, ground forces from North Korea. It's not clear, you know, how many. Reports vary from 1,500 to 10,000. Zelensky has said 10,000. We don't really know yet. But that does also seem to be a tacit admission that Putin's got a pretty serious vulnerability here at home about actually making people fight the war. Am I wrong about that?
No, I think it's a great point. It's one of, I think, several lessons we can take from that mobilization effort that began in September 2022, the first of which is that, yes, Putin does have vulnerabilities, that authoritarians still rely on some core groups to support them. And arguably, we in the West have not been very good at exploiting this vulnerability in Putin, unfortunately. It has allowed him, however, to dragoon a bunch of ethnic groups that Putin probably sees as dispensable in Russia. I mean, how else could you see those groups given how they've been used? But I also think it's probably a recognition that the 10 years of transformation that went on before the war really wasn't as successful as the Russians were telling themselves or us in the lead up to the war. This development of what they called a highly professionalized yet smaller army was not up to the task of the initial phase of the war and was not up to the task of a longer sustained war because they closed down a lot of the reserve and mobilization elements. So I think there's some important points, but also it also shows us that when you do go through a rapid expansion of a military organization, as the Russians have done, accompanied by very large casualties, you know, at the moment running up to 1,000 a day killed and wounded, there's only so much training you can give people. Training is traditionally a fairly significant bottleneck in professional military organizations in peacetime. In wartime, it is almost impossible to keep up demand. So I think what you've seen from the Russians is what they see as the only logical response to sustaining a long war. And I'd finally just say that it also shows that force ratios matter in war. For those who term themselves military theorists and think force ratios don't matter, they really do. And I think, you know, the Russians thinking they could take over a country of 44 million with 300,000 troops in a country with 250,000 troops, that was just madness. Force ratios matter. And we need to get back to thinking about these kind of issues in long, big wars.
You know, that point about mobilization, the thought that just suddenly occurred to me is I'm just trying to think about some historical cases. Of course, the United States mobilized large numbers during World War II, but it's before we're really committed and taking heavy casualties. I mean, the only country that I can think of that really was able to mobilize lots of people, and at the very end, actually have a pretty well-trained army, are the Brits during World War One, because they start with a very small professional army, which takes a lot of casualties. They raise a vast army in 1916, which is not particularly well-trained. But by the time they get to 1918, they are, and it's one of a number of ways in which kind of makes me think you can... One of the things that observing a contemporary war closely is that it can give you different kinds of questions about past wars that you thought you understood, but you don't really. And let me use that actually as a segue to one of the questions I wanted to ask you, Mick. So we've actually had a number of people on the podcast who've written books about Ukraine. You know, you tend to have Russia experts. You have journalists, many of whom spent a lot of time over there. You are really the only former general officer who's written a book about it, and a very serious book, not just opinionizing. There are plenty of generals who, with differing levels of seriousness, comment and background knowledge, comment on the war. But, you know, as we all know, writing a book is something very, very different, and doing that kind of in-depth analysis. So I'd like you to step back a bit, if you would, and just say a bit about having been a military professional, a general, and one who, after all, was basically in charge of the Australian military's higher level education system. How does it change how you frame the issues and how you think about them? And to the extent you feel able to do so, what are your strengths and weaknesses as an analyst as opposed to the other kinds of people we've been talking about?
I think it's a good point. I am a bit different to many of those commenting on the war. I am aware General Petraeus did include a chapter on Ukraine in his most recent book, so I guess I'm not the only general who's written about it, but there aren't a lot of us, although there are a few who tweet about it. I think I bring a couple of things. Firstly, I understand how military systems work. Militaries are really complex and adaptive systems focused on humans, but who also employ lots of ideas and lots of technologies in tactical, operational, strategic operations. So understanding how that system works, I think, is really, really important. Particularly training systems, how you build combined arms teams, how you build air-land operations teams. So that's important. Secondly, I think understand the political-military interface. I think that's really important to understand because really good military operations are worthless if they're not linked to sound strategic and political objectives. And I think there's a great study, a civil-military relations that emerged from this war, that what you call, Elliot, the unequal dialogue. There's been some great examples of good and bad in this throughout the war. But third, I think I bring an understanding of, you know, the difference between, you know, what Claire's what's called the nature and the character of war. I know Eric's referred to the character of war, but the nature of war is something that we refer to when you talk about the human interaction that occurs in war, the clash of wills, the duel writ large, as Clausewitz discussed, the fog, the friction of war, how surprise happens, how things happen that you don't anticipate, how things just go wrong, you know, go foobar, as the US Army might say. So I think I bring those kind of things, a personal knowledge of it, having seen it on operations, having seen it in military institutions, and it's not something that you can develop as an analyst working out of a think tank. Now, they do great work and they have many strengths that I don't, but I think I bring those three particular skills in my analytical look at the war.
Yeah, I think to that I would add that you have a systematic framework for thinking about operations and tactics and how they interact with each other that I think, unless you're really pretty deeply immersed in this stuff, you're not going to have. I was wondering, could you just say a little bit more about this distinction between the nature and the character of war? You've said a bit about the nature of war, which in some ways is unchanging or changes very little, if at all, and the character of war. What do you mean by the character of war?
Well, the character of war refers to those things in war, where they're fought, the reasons they're fought, the technologies that are used, the tactics, the strategies that are used, that continue to evolve. They evolve for various reasons. Firstly, because of the interplay of two sides, two belligerents. They change because national leaders have different objectives. They change because the world itself is evolving, technology evolves, these kind of things. So at the moment, I think we see a change in the character of war, firstly because of a lowering the barrier of some new technologies, whether it's drones, whether it's use of AI, whether it's the meshing of civil and military sensors. I think that's changed the character of the war over the last few years. I don't know that it's a revolution in military affairs, but certainly the character of war is changing because of those three things. But also I think it's evolving because the character of war is embracing large-scale confrontation between democracies and authoritarians in a way that we just have not seen for many decades. So that's what we talk about in the character. And, you know, the nature is something that is enduring, is not changing. There's some who might argue because of AI that it is. I think that's wrong because humans are still at heart making all the key decisions about war and confrontation in the modern era.
So let me ask just one more question, then I'll hand you back to Eric. So as our listeners will recall from the previous podcast, I've grown increasingly interested in this military historian, Cyril Falls, who had fought in World War I, was one of the British official history writers, was then the military correspondent of the Times, and then professor at Oxford of the history of war. And one thing he says in this wonderful little book, which has been overlooked, I think, called The Art of War, which is just a short kind of history of the evolution of war from Napoleon to the atomic age, is he says, you know, it's a mistake to think that that there's kind of really big disjunctive changes in war. He doesn't use the word disjunctive. He says, you know, on the whole, war has tended to evolve in a, you know, at a pretty much constant pace. It's always happening, sometimes a little faster, sometimes a little slower, but it's a mistake to think that there are big dramatic changes. Is that your view? And to what extent do you think there's evidence from the Russia-Ukraine war that bears on that question?
I kind of agree. I think there is a lot of continuity. You do see continuity playing out over long periods of time, but every now and then you do see discontinuities. You know, I think the precision revolution of the 1990s, 2000s, you've written about this. I think that is a bit of a discontinuity, but I think, you know, the biggest discontinuity is the birth of atomic weapons. I mean, that fundamentally changed how countries viewed strategy, how they viewed the interaction of nations in a strategic competition. And then, you know, there were probably things like wireless and aircraft and a couple of other technologies that were significant discontinuities as well. So whilst in the broad, I agree there's a lot of continuities in war, and there's certainly been a lot of continuities in the war in Ukraine, every now and then it's punctuated by a significant discontinuity which does transform the character of war. I don't think that's what we're seeing yet in Ukraine, but historians in the future may make a different judgment, and that will be their judgment to make.
Mick, another major theme and element of your book is the ability of the two sides to adapt to changing conditions and technologies on the battlefield. And I think, you know, with all the requisite spoiler alerts for potential readers of your book, you seem to suggest that overall the Ukrainians have been much more much more flexible, much more agile in adapting to changing circumstances on the battlefield. And while you point out that the Russians have made adaptations, you also say they, you know, they've continued to do some things that, you know, are repetition of failed tactics that they've used, that somehow they expect a different result, particularly the meat assaults is one example that you use. So sketch out for us, if you would, a little bit about the comparative adaptation of the two sides. And if you might then kind of segue into a discussion of leadership, because leadership plays a big role in this, in your discussion, and it plays a big role in the adaptation of strategy and not just the tactics on the ground as well.
Yeah, I think if I was to characterize the adaptation battle overall in Ukraine, it would be that the Ukrainians are superior at grassroots, bottom-up adaptation. But the Russians are probably better at large-scale strategic adaptation and industrialization of change. And I think that's a fundamental challenge for the Ukrainians, because having all the good ideas coming up to the bottom is one thing, but if you don't have the scale of defense industry or financial resources to then ensure those good ideas are made systemic and strategic, you've got challenges. The Russians, on the other hand, are pretty slow to learn. They're more fast followers of the Ukrainians than anything else. But they do have the industry. They do have the resources. Unfortunately, to be able to systematize different and new ideas. They've systematized things like coke cages very quickly, loitering munitions. They already had an advantage in artillery and munitions production, but things like the meat tactics, which aren't just throwing soldiers at machine guns, it's a bit more sophisticated. But once again, they've industrialized that, taken the idea from Wagner and basically institutionalized it across their military forces. So unfortunately, wars are won through, partially through your industrial capacity, and Russia is better at industrializing change than Ukraine is. So I think that's an important difference between the two. And as you point out, leadership is central to all this. Yes, innovation at the lower levels just happens, but you can't make it systemic without leadership decisions around priorities, resource allocation, allocation of time, which is what leaders probably have are most important to do. Adaptation has to be led. And I think that's a really important point to note when we look at adaptation, whether it's tactical, strategic, or even political levels.
I mean, you make another very important point in the book, which is that not all adaptation is good. I mean, there's a kind of a, in the literature, there's sometimes, as you point out, a kind of assumption that adaptation in and of itself is inevitably going to lead to greater military effectiveness. And as you point out, that's not always the case. I mean, one example, I guess, would be on the point of leadership. The Russians have changed out their leadership repeatedly and without, I would say, a lot of notable increase in effectiveness. I mean, as you pointed out, I think the UK MOD intelligence has suggested that in September they were losing 1,200 folks a day, which is just an astonishing, level of casualties for in modern warfare. Could you talk a little bit about the sort of adaptation failures, as it were?
Yeah, not every good idea works out, and there's sure to be many on the front lines that we've never heard about just because they didn't work. I think some of the ideas we're seeing at the moment from the Russians, motorcycle troops and these kind of things, I don't think they're good adaptations. They've largely failed. The turtle tanks, I think, work for a short amount of time, but have now really not disappeared, but aren't being used as much. And there's this great idea that, I read in Harvard Business Review about a decade ago called transitory advantage, where because of the pace of change in the world, when you do develop advantage, it lasts much shorter than ever before. So you get some adaptations that just don't work out very well. And then you have others that work for a short time and then have declining effectiveness. I think, HIMARS is a great example of this. In the first month, it was extraordinarily effective. It's still effective. I mean, it hasn't been degraded as much as some will have us believe. But the Russians have largely adapted to the range and the weapons characteristics of HIMARS. So when you look at adaptation, you look at ones that work for a short time, and ones that don't work. And that's how I think we look at adaptation more holistically.
That is one of the reasons, I think, why it's been in some ways so heartbreaking to see us give the Ukrainians the capability that they need, but too little of it. And we don't seem to give it with the sense of urgency and with the awareness, as you say, that any advantage you get from these things will be transitory. And so you want something that can, where you really can maximize the effectiveness immediately. You, just on the question of leadership, do you have comments about either Sirsky or Zaluzhny, the commanders of the Ukrainian military?
Well, I think Zaluzhny did a lot of things to ensure that, firstly, the Ukrainian armed forces survived the initial onslaught. And I think that was actually a considerable achievement, given some of the challenges in the Ukrainian government before the war, that, some politicians didn't accept that this would happen until very late. So Zaluzhny did some things, off his own recognizance, basically, that allowed the Ukrainians to disperse and survive the initial onslaught of the Russians. I think his leadership in the first year of the war was very fine. He clearly was one of these leaders who had learned about Western ideas, was not a traditional Soviet mold, centralist. He set up, I think, a fairly effective general staff, gave his people a fair bit of trust. But, you know, by the time he was leaving, I think the failed counteroffensive, I think the breakdown in civil-military relations between him and his president, he had to go. In a democracy, that doesn't work. And the president, at the end of the day, in the unequal dialogue, wins. So he had to go. I think Sirski, you know, it's still kind of early days. The Kursk offensive, I look at that, I know we'll talk about that. It gives me heart that they have learned from 2023, but whether it was the right campaign at the right point in time, I think we might discuss. One of the things that still kind of concerns me about Ukraine is command and control. I mean, we have this old saw that, you know, amateurs talk tactics, professionals talk logistics. Well, that's wrong. Professionals talk command and control. Whether it's national, whether it's inside military organisation, that is the first and most important thing professional military leaders and their political overlords need to discuss. And I think the command and control between a normal Ukrainian brigade and the general staff is a little unclear and a little haphazard. I mean, there's these regional commands, but I do think the inability to embrace things like divisions and corps has hampered things like span of control, span of command, unity of effort, building sufficient enablers in some elements of the war effort. That's one area that I hope Sirski might be able to address. It's a bit of a grey area for me and for a lot of analysts, and I think it's part of the military system that you know, I continue to look at and hope we might see some changes in.
Could I just draw you out on that and then hand you back? Again, for the benefit of our listeners, when you're talking about divisions and corps, I know what you're talking about. But if you could talk about that, because there has been a trend in modern militaries to move to the brigade level, and in some cases even take out the division level. But maybe just start with the sort of the elementary things. What is a brigade? What is a division? What is a corps? You know, why are those higher level formations really important? What are some of the pluses and minuses? But just let's start with the primer. What do you mean by brigades and divisions and corps?
Yeah, well, a brigade normally has 3 to 4 fighting battalions plus supporting battalions, engineers, artillery, these kind of things. You know, the fighting battalions can be armour or infantry. A division is normally 3 to 4 fighting brigades. There's a good reason why it's 3 to 4. You know, human beings under good conditions can normally manage up to about 7 things beneath them, you know, 7 units, 7 subunits. But under conditions of stress, you know, cognitive science has proven this, you can probably only focus on 3, at most 4 things. So that's how militaries are organised, in 3 to 5s, because under the stress of battle, when commanders are tired, under physical threat, have little time, managing 3 to 4 elements underneath you is about as much as you can do. So when I see regional commanders who have, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 brigades under them, I just don't see how that can work, you know, when you're under a lot of stress. So that's why we form divisions, because it's the level and the amount of brigades underneath them that a single human and a commander and his staff can wield effectively over time. And then corps are, you know, several divisions above that. Now, I know there's layers there, but that is how we've historically proven is the best way to manage large-scale ground combat formations. And by the way, that is what we're all going back to. That's what the Australian Army has returned to with fighting divisions, with warfighting brigades underneath. It's how we work with the US Army, who are, you know, fighting at brigade, division and corps level. That's how we expect to fight in the future. Now, there's more technology, there's different tactics, it's joint, there's air land, there's amphib, all that kind of stuff. But this 3-5 idea of organizing it, you know, in companies, battalions, brigades, corps works, and that's why we do it.
One of the adaptations on the Ukrainian side that you cite in the book, not working, and your book really walks right up to it because it's about the counteroffensive, the failed counteroffensive last summer, is that the Ukrainians were unable to absorb some of the high-end equipment that was provided by the West, tanks and infantry fighting vehicles and some other equipment, and able to mount effective sort of combined arms operations against these very heavily fortified Russian lines, particularly in the south, but also the east. Some of that, I think, again, correct me if you think this is wrong. Some of that is attributable to our slowness in the West in providing them with a lot of that equipment, which allowed General Surovikin and others to dig in and build those multiple lines of defense that you document, the dragon's teeth, the trenches, the minefields, etc. But some of it also seems to have been inability of the Ukrainians to execute a kind of mobilization of their own manpower and train their forces. Again, some of the training deficiencies appear to be ours in the sense that many of these Ukrainian troops went to Grafenwehr in Germany or other places to train. And you read anecdotally that there was a lot of complaining among Ukrainian troops that the training they got from US and NATO trainers was not very realistic compared to the war that they found themselves actually fighting. But some of it appears to be deficiencies of training on their own. And those deficiencies appear to be continuing and to be limiting for the Ukrainian military in this sort of uneven warfare with the mass of Soviet manpower. I mean, could you comment on that, failed adaptation? And how much of it do you think explains some of where we are today?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of blame to go around here for the counteroffensive and you know, the political, in particular, outcomes of the failed counteroffensive. I mean, firstly, this was a failure of policy in the West. You know, when the Ukrainians should have been able to exploit the Russian reverses in Kherson and Kharkiv, we were having this great tank debate. You know, was giving tanks to Ukraine escalatory? It's like, give me a break. Really? You know, there's already thousands of tanks on the battlefield. How is a couple hundred more tanks going to escalate the situation here? So we're in the middle of that. So there was delay in provision of equipment. So that was a contributor. Which meant the Ukrainians then had to fight through this defensive zone, which didn't exist in October, November 2022. But it's only a partial contributor. I mean, I think another contributor was that some in the West and Ukraine thought they could raise brand new brigades, and if they were given lovely Western equipment, they would be up to the task. Well, that's just not true. We knew that. People knew that. Professional military people know that it takes a very long time to train a competent combined arms team, particularly to conduct offensive operations through obstacles. There is no harder military mission than that. You can't take people off the streets and do that. That was an intellectual failure on the part of both NATO and Ukraine. And third, you know, we failed to appreciate that deep offensive zones are hard to get through, particularly if you don't have air cover. So I think there was a whole bunch of policy and intellectual failures in the West and in Ukraine that combined to see the counteroffensive fail pretty quickly, actually. I think the Ukrainians knew within 48 hours it wasn't working. And the final part is, and I think the Ukrainians recognize this in the conduct of Kursk, they used green units in the hardest military mission that they had. and they left their experience units out. Now, they remedied this in Kursk, clearly recognising that that's what they should have done in 2023. So I think, you know, there was a failure of policy. There was an intellectual failure at different levels. And ultimately, this was a failure of leadership, which Zelensky, I think, rightly took responsibility for. And I think Zelensky made the right decision in holding him accountable. But one final point I would raise. The information operations, the public relations in the lead-up to the counteroffensive made it very hard for the Ukrainians to be successful. It was built up so much, particularly in the West, but also by Zelensky to a degree, that it would have been very hard for the Ukrainians to do anything that would have been seen as a success, even if they achieved more. That's why they took a very different approach to the Kursk offensive. There was no leaks out of Western capitals. There's one in particular that's renowned for it. And I think the Ukrainians also learned that lesson.
So let me just, one angle on that. I have to say, as I've watched this and thought about it, and also watching the Middle East conflict, as you are as well, there's a part of me which kind of questions our military judgment. I mean, there's a separate set of questions for the Ukrainians, as you point out, but we give them terrible advice, really terrible advice, for which there was no excuse. And yet, you know, the United States in particular, but other countries as well, have these, you know, highly professional militaries with very developed military academic structures. You know, you've attended the School of Advanced Warfare, SAW, run by the Marine Corps. There's the School of Advanced Military Studies, with the U.S. Army. Is there something problematic about Western professional military judgment? Because I will confess, I was really shaken by just how bad our advice seemed to be.
You know, I wish there was a simple answer to that. I think there's a wide variety of competency in Western military judgment. I think at the macro level, I think we've had, 30, 40 years of either brushfire wars in Iran, Iraq and Afghanistan or peace. And I think you see it in some respects, a different breed of senior military officer. So I think that contributes. I mean, you get some that are just absolutely magnificent at every level of war and some who are absolutely magnificent in managing a committee room. And sometimes the wrong people are giving advice to politicians or foreign military. So I think that's partially a contributor. I think Western military culture at the moment isn't focused on winning wars. I think it's been focused on different things for the last 30 years, and we really need to fix that. Now, that's happening. I see that in places like Indo-PACOM at the moment, but I don't think that's happening more broadly in some militaries. Secondly, I think there's three ways that advice can be taken when you give it. I mean, sometimes advice from, say, a big organization like the US military is designed to build a second US Army, and that's clearly not right. And I've seen that in different places. Sometimes the advice just doesn't understand the context or the organization or the history of the culture. A second way advice is taken is it can be ignored. It could be good advice that those you're giving it to ignore it. And that has happened at times with Ukraine. There has been periods where good advice has been given and the Ukrainians gone, oh, that's, we're not going to do that. And third, sometimes good advice is given, it's received, it's taken and implemented and used well. So I think there's probably examples of all three in this war. But I do think the macro challenge we have is some military leadership development and selection models have not yet transitioned to the era we are now in, which is large-scale confrontation with authoritarians who want to extinguish our systems. And we've got to fix that, and we've got to fix it quickly.
Mick, you talk about, you gave early on in the fight, and you develop in the book a pretty good rubric for the Ukrainian strategy, which is, as you describe it, a strategy of corrosion. And it's more than kind of the traditional idea of attrition, although it encompasses attrition, because as you argue, it's not just about attriting the military forces. It's actually about corroding the ability of Russia to be able to wage the war, both by attacking the logistics that support the military operations, as well as inflicting casualties at the front, and also waging strategic and influence operations globally, and certainly at the Russian public, although that probably has been the least successful, I would say, kind of element of this. To Elliot's point, I get a sense that that's not a strategy that finds favor with folks in our military, who are more inclined to, you know, sort of argue for decisive battle. And you see that reflected, for instance, in some of the criticism of the failed offensive in 2023 that you saw in the press, where you saw unnamed U.S., you know, military and defense officials saying, we told them to concentrate everything in the, you know, one axis of advance into the south. They didn't do that. They had all these people, focused on attriting Russians in Bakhmut. We told them that was a mistake, et cetera. What's your take on all that? I'm just curious.
Firstly, strategy of corrosion. I know it's something that drives some purists crazy. They said there's only two strategies. I use this strategy of corrosion to show that, you know, in modern war, there's much larger surface areas of society that are directly in contact with each other. It's not just about militaries fighting, and it's not just militaries fighting through their societies. Societies are in direct contact with each other, trying to corrode the will of the entire nation, not just the military forces that are fighting. You've seen this, you know, whether it's through crowdfunding on both sides for weapons and other things, through the direct contact between Ukrainian Russian citizens who are relatives, who have traveled to each other's countries over the last several generations. So I thought corrosion explained that better, because this is a societal interaction that you didn't really see in, you know, the wars of the 20th century. You didn't see it in the brushfire wars of Iraq and Afghanistan. So I wanted a word that kind of explained that societal interaction better. The quest for decisive battle, well, you know, you've still got to do that. You can't win wars without winning battles, but wars are about more than winning battles. And I think it's about how do you balance the ability to decisively defeat your enemy on the battlefield, whether it's in the air, in space, on the surface or under the ocean or on the ground, but also be able to defeat them economically, defeat them in the diplomatic realm, and most importantly, defeat their will. Defeat their strategy to achieve what they want out of wars. I think, you know, if we can balance all those things beyond just decisive battle, we'll be in a better place. But, yeah, unfortunately, too many militaries, we are overly focused on the decisive battle when there's far more to winning wars than that. Wars aren't military affairs, they're national affairs.
You know, that's a long-standing theme in military history, where you have military theorists who are looking for the decisive battle, and whether it's, you know, submarine, anti-submarine warfare or strategies which are of corrosion or attrition, which could be something a little bit different, militaries don't really like it. We're getting close to the end, so I have one final question I wanted to pose to you, which I think is related to all this. So it seems to me that there are really four campaigns going on here. There is a kind of terrestrial combat. That's the part of the war that looks most like World War I, although, as you pointed out, it's not really World War I, it's something different. There is a maritime war where the Ukrainians have probably been most successful in basically defeating the Black Sea fleet, sinking about a third of it, and putting it in a position where it can't really restrict Ukrainian exports. There is a ranged war. I think that's the kind of term of art which I'll use. That is where both sides are hammering each other. The Russians going after power generation, but also just kind of terror bombing of Ukrainian cities, the Ukrainians increasingly, and you know, this is something that I think people have sort of missed, being able to reach quite deep into Russia and attack very valuable targets related to the production of energy and also just military logistics. And then, as we were discussing before we got on, an information political war, which includes subversion, but also black propaganda, white propaganda, and all that. So four different campaigns. And my question to you is, do you feel that those just sort of march in parallel? Which is, you know, I've always thought, I've never really particularly liked the American jargon about lines of effort, because it implies that these things are each in their own lane. Whereas my instinct is, no, they're actually kind of interactions and synergies and so on. So could you just talk about the relationship among those four different campaigns? And if you think there are five, you know, let me know what they are.
Firstly, as someone who's been taught campaign planning by the best at the School of Advanced Warfare at Quantico, I love lines of effort. It's at least a way of intellectually thinking about different campaigns. But, you know, I think it's a pretty reasonable summary of the key campaigns. The only one I would possibly add is the Ukrainian air, missile and drone defense campaign, because that is clearly strategically and politically important for their country. But I do think there is an interaction between them. That's why you have a general staff. You know, both Russia and Ukraine have variations of the general staff at the strategic political interface that I think is important, not just for integrating military operations and campaigns, but ensuring they align with political outcomes. I think Putin and Zelensky have a fairly well-honed nose for, you know, how military operations might support their political objectives. Now, whether they're the right or wrong political objectives is another question, but I do think the presidents of both countries have a fairly good sense of how those campaigns integrate into an overall political objectives. And I think Zelensky kind of integrates all those things into his new victory plan. Now, you can have a long conversation about whether the victory plan is the right one, whether it's the right time, whether it's the right elements. But I do think, you know, there is a form of integration, even if it's loose, between those campaigns, and that ultimately both sides, particularly Ukraine, seek to use it to achieve the political objective, which is to beat the Russians and have them out of Ukraine.
Mick, this is going to be our last question. I wonder if you could give us kind of your thumbnail sketch of where we stand in the war today. I mean, you've written about the Ukrainian Kursk offensive. Obviously, the Russians are attacking on kind of two salients on either side of the main axis of advance that the Ukrainians took into Kursk. You've written about that. There are these micro advances that they've made. I mean, Vuhledar has fallen, which sort of is a kind of hinge between the southern theater and the eastern theater of operations, but really not much progress towards Pokrovsk or to Chasiv Yar, which, you know, 2-3 months ago people were saying key strategic, you know, territory that's, you know, about to fall to these Russian advances. They're taking these incredible losses. They're bringing in North Korean troops. They've wreaked enormous destruction on Ukrainian energy infrastructure, which portends a kind of long, cold winter for Ukrainian citizens as the weather starts to get worse. And looming all of over this, of course, is our own presidential election and the question of whether there'll be more aid forthcoming to Ukraine or not. Some efforts by Europeans to front load or, you know, pre-position stuff in case there's a cutoff by a putative Trump administration. And in general, I would say there's a sort of sense of, you know, sort of gloominess that this is not going as well as, you know, many of us would have hoped. Tell us kind of where you think this all stands.
Unfortunately, I think that's a really accurate and good summary of where we're at the moment. I think if I was use one word for Ukraine's situation at the moment, it would be grim. It's recoverable. But at the end of the day, despite the fact that Russia is only taking very small portions of Ukraine in the east and taken massive losses. Putin has been able to leverage this to change the perception of many in the West, particularly politicians who know nothing about strategy or military affairs, to have them think, well, the Russians are doing well, maybe now's the time to negotiate. Now, they've totally abrogated their responsibilities in saying we want Ukraine to win. I still haven't heard any politician to say that, certainly didn't hear it in the presidential debate in the US. I think the problem Ukraine really has at the moment is too many leaders are more afraid of Russia losing than Ukraine losing. And that is both a strategic and a moral problem in Western leadership at the moment is, one, we don't know how to win, and secondly, we haven't decided we want to win. And until we do that, I think Ukraine is going to continue to have problems.
And as you point out in your book at the end, with potential consequences for how this ongoing struggle between democracies and autocracies will play out in the future. Mick, thank you so much for joining us. Our guest today has been Mick Ryan, the author of The War for Ukraine, Strategy and Adaptation Under Fire. He's also the author of War Transformed and Futura Doctrina, a terrific Substack. Everyone should immediately subscribe to it. And Mick, we hope to have you back in the future, hopefully with a more upbeat discussion of where we stand in the war. But thank you for this.
Thank you, Eric. Thanks, Elliot. It's been great to be with you again.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 27th through July 7th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.